Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
I'm Alicia García Herrero.
And today we will talk about how China came to dominate the world of electric cars. This episode is part of Bruegel's focus on global China as seen from Europe, which includes our monthly newsletter, Zhonghua Mundus. The link to subscribe is in the show notes. I'm happy to host today Zhe Yang, who covers technologies in China and East Asia for the MIT Technology Review. Hi, Zhe, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming here at The Sound of Economics. Let's go back to the topic. China has become a world leader in making and buying electric vehicles, and this has happened somehow under the radar. In just the past 2 years, the number of electric vehicles that have been sold annually in China grew from 1.3 million to 6.8 million, making 2022 the eighth consecutive year in which China was the world's largest market for electric vehicles. For comparison, the United States only sold about 800,000 electric vehicles in 2022. Zhe, how exactly did China manage to pull this off? When did China start investing in electric vehicles and why?
I think it really goes back to like the very early 2000s, like 2001, when electric vehicle would kind of set up a scientific research project to receive state funding. And then around the time of 2008, it became more like a commercial application project. So this is a time around when Chinese companies will start to release their electric vehicle models, or even though very premature at the time, and like the government will be starting to give them subsidies and policies to help them grow. And really, I think there are three parts of the story. The first part is that there is the government who's very proactive about like subsidizing, growing the industry. And then there are the Chinese companies who, I have to say, themselves prove that they can actually make it work. Like the Chinese companies who make EV models or make EV batteries, they make it work that like there can be affordable and easy to use electric vehicles. And the last part is the Chinese consumers, because like even if you have done all that, if the consumers don't respond to you, it means nothing. So what we're seeing that right now, the Chinese consumer actually are responding that, okay, I would like to buy it. I would like to try the electric vehicle. I would like to buy it as my first car, second car. And all of those combined together make the kind of a current prosperous electric vehicle market in China.
Alicia, you've been observing this trajectory, and in a couple of past episodes of The Sound of Economics, we've been speaking about China's innovation drive. And this is also the opportunity to get a little bit in-depth on a case study about what has been going on a specific sector. What is your view about this historical trajectory of investment into the new technology, which is represented by the electric vehicles?
I would say that China has been aiming at becoming a global leader in autos, actually, for a long time. But the gap for combustion engine cars was so large that China realized that they may as well leapfrog the new technology. And I think they made a number of strategic choices, which were, in my opinion, the right choices compared to Japan and Europe, which is that they didn't go for hybrid. They went with a lot of subsidies, but we're all doing that at this point in time. So, you know, nothing to blame China on because we're all following. But the point is, they kind of got the right one, and they put that at the very high end of their industrial policy through Made in China 2025 and thereafter. So they allowed for a lot of indigenous innovation. Indigenous innovation, by the way, is not only for Chinese companies, but any foreign company that is fully registering in China, i.e. say Teslas of the world, would access these subsidies, or Volkswagen for that matter. So what they really did is to attract any big player in the sector from elsewhere to innovate in China. So I guess it's not only about the market. This is what I want to say, is because the market is obviously there, but it's more than that. It's the production and the innovation. And industrial policy was indeed very important. one could argue maybe they could have done it more cheaply without, maybe not, but we don't really know. But what we know is that out of the very many different types of industrial policy that China has undergone, whether it's semiconductors or others, I would say electric vehicles, electric batteries for that matter, is probably among the most successful.
So role of the government, certainly, as you describe, Alicia, but they... Alicia also mentioned that the government was very intelligent, or like the policy that was set in place was very intelligent in order to attract innovation from elsewhere as well. And obviously, the first name that comes to my mind in this sector is Tesla. And Tesla, for example, has to do with China becoming the global electric vehicle leader. How does this fits in this picture?
Right. I think this is a really interesting question, because like when we think about like Chinese government and the foreign companies, they're usually in kind of like a tense relationship, right? Even though they sometimes benefit from each other, but they're not in the like the best relation. It's kind of different between Tesla and China, because they are really like a mutual beneficial relationship and they both have enjoyed it a lot. So on the Tesla side, they obviously they're getting a lot from China. Like right now, there is a huge market. And also, China is like a traditional production powerhouse. So right now, the Giga factory of Tesla in Shanghai is actually the company's most productive factory. It makes, I think, about half of the electric vehicle models they make every year. So combine that, and also with like the generous government subsidies the Chinese government used to give to anyone purchasing an EV in China, it means that it's really easy for Tesla to kind of like operate a business and make cars and sell cars in China. So that part of it is very easy to understand. The reverse part, I think, is more interesting, because China also sees Tesla as a really great resource or a collaborator. Because first of all, since Tesla has such a large production facility in Shanghai, it contributes to a lot to local taxation, employment. That's why the Shanghai municipal government is really fond of Tesla. But also overall, in the national market, Chinese EV companies don't just kind of like grow all of a sudden. They also need competition. They also need kind of motivation to upgrade their technology. And Tesla is that competitor that the Chinese government introduced to the local market, because Tesla has been one of the first electric vehicle company to kind of commercially produce its models. And bringing that to China, bringing those cars to the Chinese consumers to let them know that, well, this is like a viable option for all of you, it really inspires the other Chinese EV makers to try to catch up with Tesla. And I don't think most of them have done it, but this is like Tesla's kind of like the goal, hang up high up there to kind of for them to catch up on. So all of that above, like Tesla and China really kind of like both got a lot from this relationship. And that's why I think they are both still very determined to keep that going.
Alicia, what do you think about this?
Well, I like the idea that not everybody has caught up with Tesla, because if they all had, frankly speaking, side, we would be an even bigger trouble. But the point is that the Chinese EV makers actually know that not everybody can afford a Tesla. So basically, the smart thing is that they've gone really, on the one hand, trying to emulate Tesla, but most intelligently, in my view, they've gone into a different benchmark, which has allowed Chinese EV makers to become even larger than Tesla. BYD say, yeah. And why? Because they've understood that this is going to become a mass product, not a luxury product, a mass product for which subsidies are available in many countries in the world already, not only the EU and the US, although, of course, these are the largest markets so far. But it is important to realize that, say, the whole of Southeast Asia, I mean, there's no way Tesla can compete with, you know, lower end or better priced products for an income per capita of, say, 10,000, Malaysia or even lower, India, say. I think the main problem, though, for this kind of I can make it all type of Chinese EV is, of course, that not everybody wants to just import cars from China. Yeah, I mean, think about the trade deficit, the exploding trade deficits around the world, including Germany, for that matter, for that very same reason. Beyond solar panels and, of course, other types of green manufacturing. But the point is, I think the Indonesians of the world are already responding. the Indias of the world are responding. So I think these Chinese automakers, to make it short, they're having a different strategy to Tesla, again, going back to Tesla, which is that I'm going to produce in Indonesia, I'm going to produce in India if allowed. And I think Tesla is more retrenching toward its more native markets, yeah, whether it's Europe, whether it's the US. So in that regard, I think it's been very, very smart. And that's why, again, we are what we are. This is the largest EV supplier, let alone, I mean, producer, let alone, of course, the largest EV market in the world.
Zay, you want to add something to what Alicia said?
Right. I totally agree with what Alicia just said. And I just want to add that, like, within the Chinese domestic market, a lot of Chinese EV makers are known for making this like really affordable, really kind of like basic electric vehicle models, right? Because they kind of advertise that as like the young people's first car, right? If you're just looking for a ways of commuting, like daily commute, if you're not using this for like long road trips, then you just need a small car with a very short range, very small battery, that's enough. But it's like the most affordable option for you, for someone who's just out of college. And that kind of is something that Tesla cannot do. They cannot really cater to this part of the market. But through doing that, like they kind of acquire the experience of making electric vehicle, of like appealing to Chinese consumers. And maybe they can grow to make better, more luxury cars in the future. But they're really starting from there. They're very good at that, like specific, like low-end market.
Yes, and I want to go back to the issue of the other countries in a second, because this is going to be quite an interesting part of the story. But going back to the production side and the global value chain, which is related to that, because this is also has a global geopolitical implication, if I may say, there is definitely one single piece of technology which is fundamental to make an electric car moving, and this piece of technology is the battery. So I think it would be interesting for our listeners to understand a little bit better how and what kind of role the battery technology plays in all this, but also and especially from you, Zay, and then maybe Alicia can give a bit more of a global overview on the global value chain, which is linked to the production of batteries, because this goes into some territory which we've been exploring, for example, when we speak about critical raw materials and stuff like this. But first and foremost, what about these batteries?
Right. I think maybe if people haven't paid attention to electric vehicles, they may not know that like the battery is like more important to electric vehicle than a gas engine is to like a traditional car, because like the battery is kind of where the most expensive part of the car is. It like takes a lot of space. So in order to make a electric vehicle that is competitive, that is like affordable, the real obstacle there is how to make a good and affordable battery. And that is where the Chinese companies have come a long way in the past decade, because some of them, particularly like CATL, which is currently the largest battery company in the world, they have really kind of like improved the technology to make batteries that are safe, they're easy to transport, they're affordable, and they're easy to be kind of like customized into different vehicles. And that is very like essential to making an electric vehicle. So right now, even if for a foreign automaker, let's say Ford or General Motors, if they want to make an electric vehicle, they have to face the fact that these Chinese battery suppliers can make them more affordably and more reliably. So do they still want to kind of like make a battery of their own and invest in all the research, R&D, and the production? Or do they want to work with the Chinese collaborators? The latter one has like a lot of incentive in terms of price. So that is why kind of like Chinese battery companies has really kind of like emerged as the leader of the market. And that helps the EV companies too, because they are also based in China. Their production facilities are closer. So it helps them reduce their cost too. And all of that is like just very important for making sure that like an EV is not kind of like sold at an obscene price, and people are not just buying for technology, but also buying for the economics of it.
Alicia, how do we relate with our more broader conversation on GVCs?
Yes, and I guess you referred to critical dependencies and, you know, all of that. So I would say that First of all, China indeed has gone a long way on what is most important, which is the battery. So the degree of concentration of exports is bigger for batteries than for EVs as a whole. So that's basically one aspect of this. On top of that, CATL or other companies for that matter are building factories elsewhere. So it's not only the exports, but also basically a lot of FDI, foreign direct investment, produced elsewhere. But, and I think this is what we are starting to see, and in a way we can see the impact on the prices of those critical materials from which we are dependent on. Because on the one hand, a lot of those critical, not only the battery, but the components of the battery are basically in Chinese hands, whether it's indirectly, the control of the mines. In some cases, they're even in China, like rare earth metals. But the most important part is the refining of any of those critical materials, whether it's cobalt, whether it's graphite or nickel or lithium. And the key here is that the rest of the world is starting to feel squeezed about this, because it's not only you sell the battery, let alone the car, it's that you also control the minerals needed for anybody else to do the same. And I think that's where the story starts reversing, if I may say. We're at the beginning of that reversal. Yeah, we have IRA, Inflation Reduction Act in the US, with huge targets for local production, but also basically the control of those critical materials. In Europe, we have Critical Raw Material Act. We have, you know, Net Zero Industrial Act. All of that, in a way, is a response to the fear that China may either, but because it's not only about retaliation, it's even if there were no retaliation, if something were to happen in China, yeah, imagine whatever, an earthquake, any kind of event, negative event, unfortunately, would have implications, humongous implications for that supply chain you're referring to, Giuseppe. So I would not only talk about retaliation, although unfortunately we had the first case only a couple of days ago with two specific rare earth metals. But it's not about that only. It's the fact that for anything you want to do which is relevant, you don't want to have 80, 90% of concentration in a single country. So my sense is that the production of batteries from China will at some point wane, meaning it will plateau. Maybe I should say it will plateau. And others will start producing more batteries. This has already started with South Korea. South Korea has increased its market share in the last 3 years. And I think it's a response to others feeling, well, you know what, I may as well have part of my batteries from South Korea, especially the US. So that's where we are heading.
Having said that, what would be interesting now, on one hand, is to look at the situation of the market that we described so far. Already, Alicia has been mentioning the possibility that the battery production might plateau at some point. I wonder what are the implications for the electric vehicle market. We've been seeing this very spectacular growth, very fast growth, and so forth. What the market looks like now after these years of development in China?
So I'll do a very quick one because it's not only China. I think it will plateau, I wouldn't say everywhere, but certainly I think in countries where there's been big subsidies, China is one of them. I think it is very easy that we'll see a plateau. And the prices of these critical raw materials are starting to show that. You look at how prices of nickel, lithium are evolving, you can already see that the market is saying, okay, this was a great ride. But, you know, once the subsidies are lifted, once you have kind of the base effect already there, meaning the stock there is about the flow. I mean, in emerging countries, this is not the case, but there are no subsidies. So, you know, it's going to take much longer there to get where China got very, very quickly. And therefore, I think the demand will not be as exponential as people think. That's just my guess.
Zai, do you agree with this view?
Oh, yeah, totally. The context in China is that after over a decade of providing subsidies for EV purchasers, they officially ended that at the end of last year. So this is the first year, if you want to buy an EV, there's actually no subsidy for you anymore. And that means that it's possible that the price will just jump up like quite a lot, which I think it did at the end of last year. But then the problem for the markets that, well, the consumers now having second thoughts, right? Well, do I still want to pay for the same model if the price increased? Or like, should I want to wait a little longer to see what's like the best car model for me? And the result is that there's like a really intense price competition in the Chinese market right now. A lot of them are reducing their prices in honestly a non-sustainable way. And some of them are kind of like really trying to clear their stock. All of that created like a kind of a chaos in the market right now. But I think the effect of that is that right now there are really a lot of EV brands in China. And maybe that's not a sustainable future. Maybe in the future, there are only kind of like 5 or 6. They're really going to survive and thrive. But now we're probably entering a phase where some of the companies with less technological know-how, the companies with less production capability, they're going to be squeezed out of the market. They're going to lose in this competition. And unfortunately, even though some of like the star startups are showing signs of weakness right now, so it's really hard to see kind of like which Chinese company is going to love at the end. But we are seeing the kind of a like market consolidation, the kind of like intense competition in China right now. And it's probably going to keep like that for a while.
This is very interesting, but to challenge a bit both of you more on the international scale, I mean, the European Union is trying to phase out fossil fuel vehicles in the next decades, and this will mean inevitably a boom of the electric vehicles, globally speaking. So how this story that you are trying to tell about a market which is being cannibalized by itself on one hand, but then a situation where we will need more electric vehicles and more affordable electric vehicles all in all, how these two kind of sides can reconcile themselves, if I may ask, because to me it's not very clear.
Very quickly on Europe, I think you're right that, you know, like we've given subsidies. Unfortunately, people use them for hybrid cars and maybe they didn't actually, you know, use much the electric part of that, and maybe we missed an opportunity. You see what I mean? Like if we subsidize only electric vehicles, we would have done much more already. But to be very frank, we have already out there two things coming for Europe. One is that the next generation funds are already in play and there is a lot of money there, but whatever was for electric vehicles, that's it. You know, it's like I don't think anybody's going to review that any higher because there's a lot of other things. Yeah, it's about storage, a green hydrogen, you know, it's not all about electric vehicles at the end of the day. And by the way, transportation in particular, car transportation, if I recall correctly, something like 18% of the emission. You know, there's lots of things out there that we need to deal with, whether it's shipping. And I know this is a big deal for China, but, you know, like frankly speaking, no matter what we say, Europe's decarbonization is not all about electric vehicles. So to me, what's going to happen is that, and I forgot, and also we have the fiscal rules coming back, yeah, Giuseppe? So, you know, like less space.
Alicia, if I would say, it's probably true, but German car makers have a certain stake within industrial policy in Europe. So the way this is going to affect car makers, I mean, not just Germans, I mean, of course, also French, Italians, and so on, but, you know, like how this will affect the industry will play a role.
You are right, but I would also say that exactly because of that, because some are not fully ready to switch fully to EVs, there may be some drag in their feet. You see, so in a way, it plays both ways, because if they're not ready to fully transform the production to EVs, they may want to have more time. So it's not clear. But to make a long story short, I think we need to realize that at some point, the world is going to say, okay, it's great to have an electric vehicle, but what about A, Y, Z? I mean, all of the other things we need to do beyond basically mass transportation or personal transportation. And I think that's when we're going to realize that this is just one part of the problem and many other things need to come together. And to be frank, I think I've done the numbers for China and it's very obvious that it's not the electric vehicles that are going to solve the problem, to be very frank. It's about the industry. It's about cement. It's about, you know, all of these high emission industries. So at some point, people are going to divert their attention, in my view. So yes, we'll have more electric vehicles, but whether that will be a, you know, like exponential, and that's the one and only thing we're all going to talk about. I think there's been a hype and we are plateauing. I have the feeling, not in the emerging world, but in China, maybe not in the US, because you know we have the IRA. We don't have the IRA now. You see, it's we're in a different phase. So for me, Europe is mostly about storage, green hydrogen. Yes, electric vehicles, but as you said, the industry may not want to push it so rapidly. That's my take on Europe.
Zay, what we are discussing here is also the possibility for the Chinese brands to look into these new markets. One side is the other global south developing markets, but also the European markets, and we've been seeing already some attempts to put some protectionist barrier, exactly for the reasons that Alicia said when it comes to car makers in Europe. How do you see the challenge for going beyond the Chinese market itself, which, as we've seen, has its own limits as well?
Right. I think that's certainly the thing a lot of Chinese EV brands are thinking right now. Like, how do they expand beyond the Chinese borders? But it's going to be really difficult for them because so far, I don't think there's a single Chinese car auto brand that has made it like in the global stage, right? So honestly, there's just not many experience for them to learn from. Like, how do I make a name for a Chinese vehicle without kind of like evoking the image of like a cheap Chinese product, or without evoking like the Chinese national security concerns, thoughts? There's a lot of kind of like minefields for them to navigate. And also, it also just comes down to some very basic things, like how do you tailor your marketing to a different country, to a different market? How do you provide customer service to a new market? Because like, you need to hire local, you need to respond to the problems that will only arise in that local environment. Also, just like how do you make sure you comply with all the different legal realities in all different markets? And the biggest of one of them all, like the political risk of like that can just like, I don't know, fill your whole attempt in over one night. So for these Chinese brands, there really just are a lot of obstacles in their way. But I do think they have a really strong incentive to figure them out now. And one example they might be looking at are the Chinese smartphone companies. Because these companies also went through basically all of that. Like the Chinese companies like Xiaomi, Huawei, when before it was like under the export control, or like Vivo, Oppo, these brands also kind of like really made themselves prominent players across the world. And a lot of people compare EVs to like very large smartphones. Of course, they're much more complicated than that. But people were thinking, oh, if Chinese smartphone companies could do that, maybe the EV brands can do that too. But it's going to take a while. It's going to take them at least a few years to figure out how do they break into this market. But I think they're pretty confident right now.
Alicia, do you want to add something on this?
Yes, going back to your point, and let's put it loud and clear, Macron's idea of anti-dumping instruments to basically, frankly speaking, just make Chinese cars more expensive in Europe. This might not fly, but it shows the direction. I don't think it's only going to be Europe. It's going to be India. It's going to be others. Why? Because they realize that they cannot massively increase their trade deficit just because they import every single EV car for their transition. But for Europe, maybe the anti-dumping won't fly, but one more thing could fly, which is CBAM, cross-border carbon adjustment mechanism. Yes. This cross-border carbon adjustment mechanism, so far is not applied for cars. So it's not applied for anything, but it's not in the priority list. Yeah, it's going to start with more like high emissions industries. But the point is, what if we start with electric vehicles? Because we know that they are produced with electricity that is basically coal-based. So that would make it to the same final outcome, yeah, that they would be more expensive for Europeans to buy. And this is something that I think others can replicate. If not CBAM, they can go anti-dumping, they can go simply tariffs. So the idea that China will continue to export massively, their way out, because again, the demand, internal demand is not there because the subsidies are gone. I think it's going to be increasingly difficult. And that's the plateauing story also, because others are not fully ready to come and produce because they need the critical raw materials. You see, so that in a way, unfortunately, because we want decarbonization, but my sense is it's going to naturally slow down the process, at least as electric vehicles are concerned.
A last question and a provocative one. We don't have so much time for decarbonizing our economy. It's true that electric vehicles might not be the most percentage of the problem, but they definitely constitute quite a considerable part of it. And I wonder if, once again, the fact that there is geopolitical rivalry that leaks into the economics isn't going to backfire the global goal, which should be a common goal everywhere in Europe, United States and China and the global South, to decarbonize as fast as possible, something that is, I have to say, of my concern and of concerns of many people at the moment. So I'm a little bit worried about hearing the fact that we like it or not, we have a massive scale capacity for producing cheap electric vehicles in a part of the world, no matter which is this part of the world. And the fact that the global economy is not reacting in the most efficient way. So reasoning more like a classic globalist economist thinking, that seems to be a contradiction in terms. How do we solve these idiosyncrasies of the system?
I'm not very optimistic about that, because I am seeing the topic of like electric vehicle and EV batteries and raw materials increasingly being politicized, at least in the United States. That's just not a good sign if people want to have more kind of international collaboration in terms of like producing and selling more electric vehicles. And also, just for the past few years, the tax base between US and China has been largely defined by these like geopolitical tensions and policies. So it's really easy to see how that may replicate in the EV space. That has not really happened yet. Right now, it's only a few kind of like political voices in the US asking for that to happen, but it hasn't become kind of like a large scale agreement yet, consensus yet. But in this political climate, I do think that is possible. And if that happens, it's going to be a big blow for the Chinese EV companies, for sure. I also think it's bad for the American kind of like EV market, because right now it's so young, it's so small. It really needs some more competition and kind of like motivation for it to grow bigger and faster. So unfortunately, I don't have a lot of hope here. I think if it really becomes politicized, it is going to at least derail kind of like the electrification of transportation here in the US. But hopefully, I guess in other regions, they are more welcoming of China, of Chinese vehicles. There is some kind of like globalization of electric vehicle production that can happen.
Alicia?
Yes. Well, I'm going to argue that if we want to decarbonize, yes, we need to allow for, you know, countries having a larger share of the pie, say, in this case, EVs, as long as it is, however, reasonable in terms of resilience of the supply chain. So in other words, I think there is like a limit to a monopoly or even a monopsony, yeah, in terms of acquiring critical raw materials. Why? Because it's dangerous even for China. Just imagine. I mean, it's a lot of responsibility to be the one and only producer of a good that everybody needs. And at some point, we may think this is good for China at the moment. But, you know, why are countries reacting? Because actually, it isn't as good. Because it raises the awareness of the risk, whether it's the perception of retaliation from China's side or, very simply, again, an event that China cannot control for. And I have to say, it's not only electric vehicles. Solar panels is even more extreme. It's 89% of global exports. For wind turbines, it's 64%. So, you know, if you have for every single type of green manufacturing, such a huge concentration, there's no other product in the world. If you look at, say, ICT, China doesn't have 80% of the market. No way. So, in a way, the problem here to me is that whether it's been intentional or not, I am nobody to judge. But the point is, it's been so extreme that in a way now, you're right, the world is reacting maybe wrongly decarbonization-wise because we're not ready to substitute China. But resilience-wise, maybe rightly, because this is a long game. It's not going to end in 2 or 3 months. I don't think the world can expect to be as dependent on a single country. It's never been, not even for fossil fuels, never. If I were China, I would kind of think, okay, This is not Pareto optimal for anybody. So let's try to figure other supply chains. I can take, you know, a big chunk of, say, what I know best, whatever that might be. But I would be happy to allow others to become bigger elsewhere because it's at least sustainable, even for China. So I guess this is where we should be heading. I don't think the current equilibrium is sustainable, Giuseppe. That's the problem. It is not sustainable. It's just too concentrated, from critical raw materials to refining to even innovation, and most importantly, even manufacturing at the very end of the supply chain.
And on this note, obviously, opens up 3 million other questions on the future of not just the electric vehicles and the carbonization, but also of global economy. I mean, these are the kind of things which we try to tackle in all our episodes. So it's definitely not a conversation that it's closing now. But unfortunately, this is all the time that we have for this episode. And I would like to thank both of you, Zay and Alicia, for your insights. And I would like to remind our listeners that, as usual, you can read in open access the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. So once again, thanks a lot for joining us, and until next time, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.